Well, brethren, if in our Christian life, as we try to live our life in obedience to God, I think one of the greatest challenges we can have at times is adequately managing our emotions. I think if we're all honest with ourselves, there are times we allow our emotions to take control of us, and when that happens, oftentimes our behavior is not what we'd like it to be, and we don't always behave in the most godly manner, if we allow our emotions to take control of us. And if we look at, the emotions the Bible talks about the most, there are two, you might say, that are, mentioned more than any other. One mentioned the most, you might say, is love. The other is fear. Now, personally, I would argue that love has way more to do with actions that we choose to have rather than really emotions or something that we feel. Now, fear, on the other hand, is definitely emotion. It is something that we feel and we react to. So if you look at it like that, fear is literally the most mentioned emotion in the Bible. In fact, if you look at just the word fear in the New King James translation of the Bible, it's mentioned 354 times. However, you'll also notice that the words "do not fear" show up 51 times, and the phrase "fear not" fears 11 times. So it's very much an emotion that God warns us that we have to get under control. That if we allow fear to rule us and to kind of take over our minds and be fearful individuals, the Bible literally tells us that could cost us our salvation. It's a very serious matter. We could literally wind up in the lake of fire as a result. So what we're going to do today is look at this particular subject, to understand how fear can affect us and why does God take it so seriously? Why is it something that he would put on the list of, those he's going to throw in the lake of fire? And also look at, what we can do as Christians to overcome our fears, and to adequately manage this. So if you'd like a title for this sermon, is Courage is Required for Salvation. Again, courage is required for salvation. Because oftentimes we don't necessarily look at it like that. We all know fear is something we'd like to avoid. It's not something, that we should focus on. And we all want to be courageous individuals. But we don't oftentimes think of it as courage is an absolute requirement for salvation. But as we're going to see today, it absolutely is. And that's something the Bible directly tells us is the case. Now, as I mentioned, fear is something that's talked about, again, more than any other emotion in the Bible. And God constantly gives us reassurances to the Bible that we shouldn't fear, that he will take care of us, he will deliver us through all of our trials. And we'll start off today looking at, several examples in this regard. But just keep in mind as we go through this, oftentimes we look at this, again, as more of a pep talk or just reassuring words and don't necessarily, think of it in terms of, not fearing and having courage to face our fears is a requirement for salvation. So let's start off, first of all, turn over to Deuteronomy chapter 31. Deuteronomy 31. We'll look here at an example towards the end of Moses' life. Advice he's giving to all the people of Israel and even to Joshua specifically. It's Deuteronomy 31 in verse 1. Then Moses went and spoke these words to all Israel. And he said to them, I am 120 years old today. I can no longer go out and come in. Also, Jehovah has said to me, you shall not cross over this Jordan. And Jehovah your God himself crosses over before you, and he will destroy these nations from before you, and you shall dispossess them. Joshua himself crosses over before you, just as Jehovah has said. And Jehovah shall do to them as he did to Sihon and Og and the kings of the Amorites in their land, and he destroyed them. Jehovah will give them over to you, and you may do to them according to every command with which I have commanded you. Be strong and of good courage. Do not fear nor be afraid of them, for Jehovah your God, he is the one who goes with you, and he will not leave you nor forsake you. Then Moses called Joshua and said to him in the sight of all Israel, be strong and of good courage, for you must go with this people to the land which Jehovah has sworn to their fathers to give to them, and you shall cause them to inherit it. And Jehovah, he is the one who goes with you, and he will be with you, and he will not leave you nor forsake you. Do not fear nor be dismayed. As I mentioned, we see throughout the Bible again and again God saying, do not fear. Just trust in me. I've got your back. I'll take care of this. You don't need to be afraid of anything. And this is a theme all throughout the Bible. This is stated again and again. So let's look at just a couple more examples here. Turn over to Isaiah 35. Isaiah chapter 35. We'll start in verse 3. So strengthen the weak hands and make them firm, and make firm the feeble knees. Say to those who are fearful hearted, be strong, do not fear. Behold, your God will come with vengeance, and with recompense, the recompense of God, he will come and save you. In other words, you don't need to be afraid. Your father's got it all taken care of. He's going to take care of you and deliver you through whatever comes at you. You don't need to fear. Now turn over to Isaiah 51. See another similar example. Isaiah 51 and verse 7. Listen to me, you who know righteousness. You people in whose heart is my law, do not fear the reproach of men, nor be afraid of their revilings. For the moth will eat them up like a garment, and the worm will eat them like wool. And my righteousness will be forever. My salvation is from generation to generation. Again, the Bible is full of reassuring words like this. You know, of God continually telling his people and telling all of us, you don't need to fear. You know, I'm a loving father. I'm there for you. You trust in me. I will take care of you. You have nothing to be afraid of. You know, and you see this again and again and again all throughout the Bible. It's a very common theme. You know, but oftentimes I have to say we sometimes look at this really as, you might say, you know, just kind of a comforting words or like a motivational speech to, you know, to kind of give us the courage to face things. Oftentimes we don't look at it as this is an absolute requirement. This is something I have to do. I have to be willing to face my fears, you know, and to take them on. Because if we don't, we could literally lose out on salvation, you know, and wind up in the lake of fire. You know, oftentimes we don't look at it quite that seriously, but that is exactly how the Bible speaks of the subject. Now turn over to Revelation chapter 21, and you'll notice here why I say that. Revelation chapter 21. We'll start here in verse 6. And he said to me, it is done. I am the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end. I will give of the fountain of the water of life freely to him who thirsts. He who overcomes shall inherit all things, and I will be his God, and he shall be my son. But now notice the list in verse 8 here. But the cowardly, unbelieving, abominable, murderers, sexually immoral, sorcerers, idolaters, all liars, shall have their part in the lake of fire which burns with fire and brimstone, which is the second death. Notice we have a list of basically character traits in saying those who have these, you know, and allow this to rule their lives, you know, these are the people that are going to wind up in the lake of fire. You know, they're going to lose out on the kingdom of God and lose their salvation and be burned up for eternity. You know, notice the first thing on the list. It says the cowardly. What we're referring to here is the fearful. Now, to explain that, let me share with you the Greek word here that's translated as cowardly. It's transliterated into English as delos. It's D-E-I-L-O-S. It's Strong's number 1169. And according to the Complete Word Study Dictionary of the New Testament by Spiros Sahaites, it's defined as to fear, timid, fearful. In other words, it's saying that the fearful will wind up in the lake of fire. Oftentimes, again, we don't think of it like that, you know, but because I'm sure we've all experienced fear in our lives. We all have those things that, you know, that scare us, that get under our skin, or we're facing a difficult trial and uncertain of our future, and we experience fear. You know, it's a very natural thing as human beings. But, it, you know, as the Bible tells us, if we're not able to get on top of that and to have the courage to face our fears, we could seriously lose our salvation over it. And again, oftentimes we don't think of it in those, you know, serious of a term. Now, to get a little, maybe a clearer idea of kind of what this is getting at, you know, to look at this this Greek word, it's only used four times in the New Testament. Now, obviously, you know, Revelation 21 is one of those four times there. Now, one time is actually in the book of Hebrews, and it's used to refer to the fear of God, which we know is a good thing. However, the other two give us a little more insight, and they're actually in the Gospels, and it's basically the same account, just, you know, just parallel accounts of the same event. They're in Matthew and Mark. And let's turn over to the example in the book of Mark. Turn over to Mark chapter 4. We'll see where this word is used again. Because what we want to see as we go through this is, why does God make such a big deal about fear? You know, why is it something that, you know, could exclude us from the kingdom of God? You know, none of us like fear. We don't like to experience it. You know, we like to avoid it. But again, we don't oftentimes think of it as something that's going to exclude us from the kingdom of God if we don't overcome it. And it's, look here in Mark chapter 4 and verse 35. And on the same day when evening had come, he said to them, "Let us cross over to the other side." Then when they had left the multitude, they took him along in the boat as he was, and other little boats were also with him. And a great windstorm arose, and the waves beat on the boat so that it was already filling. In other words, what was happening is what we oftentimes refer to today as taking on water. You know, if you're in a boat, you know, out in the lake or out in the ocean, you know, and you have a storm like this coming and it's blowing so hard that water is actually coming into the boat, you know, anyone who's ever, you know, familiar with boating knows you take on enough water in the boat sinks is what happens, you know, and that's what these guys are concerned about, as we're going to see here. They were all fishermen. They're familiar with how this works, and they're in a severe storm where it's blowing so hard, it's not only tossing the boat around, the boat's taking on water, you know. So then notice here in verse 38, but he was in the stern asleep on a pillow. And they awoke him and said to him, "Teacher, do you not care that we are perishing?" In other words, they're all panicked. They're like, "We're about to die. You know, are you not paying attention? Do you not see that we're all about to perish here?" In verse 39, "Then he arose and rebuked the wind and said to the sea, 'Peace, be still.' And the wind ceased, and there was a great calm. But he said to them, 'Why are you so fearful?'" And the word here for fearful, this is delos. This is the same word we saw there in Revelation 21. "Why are you so fearful? How is it that you have no faith?" Now notice here how he correlates being fearful with a lack of faith. You're going to see this correlation throughout the Bible as we go through this. And again, there's plenty more scriptures that address this we're not going to look at today. But you're going to see that being fearful and unbelief in God always correlate. And courage and faith and belief in God correlate with each other as well. That is a common theme throughout the Bible. And then verse 41, "And they feared exceedingly and said to one another, 'Who can this be that even the wind and the sea obey him?'" You know, they're literally looking at this going, wow, you know, what? Who is this guy? Well, obviously, they're not grasping who he is. You know, it's gone right over their head that this isn't a teacher. This is the Son of God here. You know, this is a God being who was born as a human. They're obviously not getting that. You know, and he's pointing out to, you know, he's kind of making a point of this. You're not seeing who I am and having faith in that. If you did, you wouldn't be so scared. You know, and again, if we put ourselves in their shoes, you know, being in a boat, you've got this severe storm coming on, the wind is blowing, you're taking on water. I think we can all simply, that's what, yeah, that'd be a scary situation. You know, we understand why you would feel fear. You know, so again, why is it that God would look at fear and say, well, this is something, if you don't overcome this, I'm going to throw you in the lake of fire. Well, the key to this is looking at how I like to phrase it is, how does the movie end? And I'm sure you've heard a lot of my sermons, I use that phrase a lot, you know, but oftentimes it's just looking at a situation and projecting forward and going, okay, how does this ultimately end? You know, what does this lead to? Well, what's the end result of this? You know, and that's the key to understanding why God takes such a strong stance against fear, is realizing what happens to individuals when their mind is consumed with fear and how that leads to disaster. You know, to understand that, let's turn over to Proverbs chapter 29. We'll see here a strong warning in regards to fear. It's Proverbs 29 and verse 25. The fear of man brings a snare, but whoever trusts in Jehovah shall be safe. Now again, notice that again. Trusting in God leads you to not be fearful and not overcome. And notice that it's the fear of man. As we know, the fear of God is a good thing, you know, but fearing man, that's a snare. Now, to fully understand what this means, we need to look at what the Hebrew is saying here when it refers to this as a snare. Because this gives us a lot of insight as to why fear is such a bad thing. And the Hebrew word here is translated in the English as moqes. It's M-O-Q-E-S. It's Strong's number 4170. And according to the Complete Word Study Dictionary of the Old Testament by Warren Baker and Eugene Carpenter, here's how it's defined. Quote, a masculine noun meaning a snare, a trap, bait. The proper understanding of this Hebrew word is the lure or bait placed in a hunter's trap. From this sense comes the primary use of the term to mean the snare itself. It is used to signify a trap by which birds or beasts are captured, a moral pitfall, anything that lures one to ruin and disaster. Notice what it's saying is, you know, the fear leads to ruin and disaster. You know, that's why God looks at this and says, okay, you've got to overcome this or I can't have you in the kingdom of God. Because again, we've all experienced fear in our lives, you know, whether as children or as adults, we all have situations that just rattle us and in times that we feel fear, you know, but we oftentimes, again, don't think of it as something of, you know, that's something that would exclude us from the kingdom of God. We just think of it as something unpleasant that we like to avoid. But we have to realize what happens to our thinking. And again, how does the movie end? How does that affect our minds and the decisions that we make, you know, even individuals or even large groups, of what that can result in? And it results in ruin and disaster is one of the reasons why he takes, you know, such a strong stance with this. Now, to look at some examples here, let's turn over to Exodus chapter 14. So what we're going to see today is what happens to the human mind when it gets consumed with fear. And what a negative effect that has upon thinking and decision-making that we do and the ruin and disaster that ultimately results in. Now, to fully appreciate the example here, what we're about to read here is an event that takes place as Israel is right at the edge of the Red Sea. You know, they haven't crossed it yet. But they find themselves in a situation where, you know, they're getting up to the beach of the Red Sea here. They got mountains on both sides of them. They got water in front of them. And now they see Pharaoh's army advancing behind them. They're trapped. You know, they're, you know, physically speaking, there's nowhere to go because there's not an escape route. You know, and we can understand how this would invoke fear. But let's just notice the thinking that takes place here. This is in Exodus 14 and verse 10. And when Pharaoh drew near, the children of Israel lifted their eyes, and behold, the Egyptians marched after them. So they were afraid, and the children of Israel cried out to Jehovah. And then they said to Moses, because there was no graves in Egypt, have you taken us away to die in the wilderness? Why have you so dealt with us to bring us out of Egypt? Is there not the word that we told you in Egypt, saying, let us alone that we may serve the Egyptians? For it would have been better for us to serve the Egyptians than that we should die in the wilderness. Now notice, well, fear has overcome them, and notice what a fatalistic attitude that they have. You know, but because it's also important to keep in mind what these people have witnessed to get to this point. You know, that they were slaves in Egypt, you know, all of their lives, but they've witnessed a lot of miracles along the way. You know, Moses shows up and tells them, you know, God wants to deliver you out of this, wants to take you out of slavery and deliver you to the promised land. You know, what they've seen a lot of things to validate this story because they witnessed all the plagues in Egypt, you know, things that were obviously miraculous miracles, you know, and how they were protected and how they did get released from slavery. They walked out with the riches. You know, they've seen a lot of things here, you know, to cause them to start taking God seriously and to think this guy's for real. Maybe we should trust in him to take care of us, you know, but that thought never crosses their mind. You know, they when fear overcomes them, they basically get a fatalistic attitude and then they're basically, excuse me, they're basically kind of rolling up in the fetal position, you might say, and just kind of giving up and thinking, well, we'll just go back to being slaves, you know. And they're also not considering, is there any other option here? You know, this God who's, you know, brought us to this point, maybe he'll intervene and protect us. You know, that thought isn't there. It's a very fatalistic of, well, we have no other options. We might as well just go back to being a slave. You know, and they know how negative that is, how bad that is. You know, they've lived all their lives in slavery. They know how bad that is. You know, but what's, you know, basically dominating their mind is the immediate thought of immediate pain coming upon them. Because they see the army coming at them, you know, and they can easily see, okay, they're coming to kill us. Well, that's a rational thought, you know, and but they're overcome with fear. And again, to really appreciate how this affects the mind, let's also look at another example of Israel where it's not quite so imminent. You know, in this situation, they're, you know, they're trapped between the mountains, there's water in front of them, there's an army come at them. They can look and see the army coming, you know, and it's a rational thought to think, they're all coming to kill us, you know, and we're all going to die, you know, so you can understand the fear there. Well, let's look at another example. Well, they respond very similarly, but the threat's not so imminent. Turn over to Numbers chapter 13. Numbers chapter 13. Now, again, let me just summarize some context to lead up to this situation, because I think this is important. You know, not only at this point have they witnessed all the plagues in Egypt, you know, all that took place there to get them even into freedom, but by the time we're reading the story here in Numbers 13, they've already been through the Red Sea. Now, they have watched a sea be parted. They have walked through it with walls of water on both sides of them. This had to be, you know, this catches your attention if you're going through this, as this is outside of their realm of normal. You know, they've gone all the way through the sea here. They have watched Pharaoh's army be drowned by the water coming back together. Then after this, God starts feeding them with manna. Food falls from the sky 6 days a week, you know, on a regular clock basis. And nothing shows up on the seventh day, just like God said, but he gets you, you know, twice as much on the sixth day. So miracles are a daily part of their lives that are taking place here. They have also been to Mount Sinai, you know, where they made the covenant there, but they saw, you know, the fire on the top of the mountain. They heard the booming voice, you know, so much so that it scared them. And they're like, God, you know, Moses, God's scary. You just talk to him and you tell us what he said, because we're afraid of him. You know, they have every reason to believe God is real. You know, this isn't just a fairy tale that Moses has told them, and he's told them some wild stories and they don't know if that's really true or not. You know, they've witnessed some incredible things at this point. You know, and this is the context that leads up to this. So now they've gotten up to the edge of the promised land, and they decide, okay, well, let's scout out the land first, you know, before we just march in there. Let's get some reconnaissance here and get some intelligence of what's going on, you know, in this area. And then they send out the spies. So let's pick up the story now in verse 26. So they departed and came to Moses and Aaron and all the congregation of the children of Israel in the wilderness of Paran at Kadesh. And they brought back word to them, to all the congregation, and showed them the fruit of the land. And they told him and said, well, we went to the land where you sent us. It is truly flows with milk and honey. And this is the fruit. Nevertheless, the people who dwell in the land are strong, and the cities are fortified and very large. Moreover, we saw the descendants of Anak there, and the Amalekites dwell in the land of the south, and the Hittites and the Jebusites and the Amorites dwell in the mountains, and the Canaanites dwell by the sea along the banks of the Jordan. And then Caleb, you know, quieted the people before Moses and said, let us go up at once and take possession, for we are well able to overcome it. But the men who had gone up with him said, we are not able to go up against the people, for they are stronger than we. And they gave the children of Israel a bad report. Now notice that phrase, bad report. We're going to come back to that a little later, kind of dissect, you know, what all this is talking about. And they gave the children of Israel a bad report of the land, which they had spied out, saying, the land through which we have gone as spies is a land that devours its inhabitants. And all the people whom we saw are the men of great stature. And when they saw the giants, the descendants of Anak came from the giants, we were like grasshoppers in their sight, and so we were in their sight. I noticed that they just gave a report to the people of, it's too strong for us. We won't be able to deal with it. We're all going to die. You know, so now notice how the people respond. In chapter 14 here, in verse 1, and all the congregation lifted up their voices and cried, and the people wept that night. And all the children of Israel murmured against Moses and Aaron, and the whole congregation said to them, if only we had died in the land of Egypt, if only we had died in the wilderness. Why has Jehovah brought us to this land to fall by the sword and our wives and children to become victims? Would it not be better for us to return to Egypt? And they said to one another, let us select a leader and return to Egypt. Now notice here, again, they just immediately, you know, you might say psychologically, just roll up in the fetal position, you know, as defeated and want to just give in, okay, I'll just go back to being a slave again. But they're not sitting in a situation now with mountains on both sides and water in front of them and an army barreling down upon them. You know, they're camped outside the promised land here, but the giants that they've gotten reports are, they're not barreling down and ready to kill them. You know, this is not all happening. They're all this afraid simply because someone told them to be afraid. But notice also the tunnel vision thinking that's taking place here. Yeah, but because they're going, oh, we're all afraid. Let's run back to Egypt and be slaves. Could there be a third option, you know, or a fourth option or a fifth option? I mean, obviously the best option is trusting in God and taking the promised land, you know. But obviously there was at least a third option because we know how the story ends. They wind up wandering around the wilderness for 40 years. You know, that was another option that didn't include just going back to Egypt and being slaves. But see, this is what happens to the mind oftentimes. You know, when one is overcome with fear, we get irrational, sometimes tunnel vision thinking, and we don't think situations through. We don't analyze, you know, the situation and try to come to a logical decision, weigh out all of our options, but because they are presented with another side of the story. You know, Joshua and Caleb tell them, no, we can take it. God's with us. We can go take the land right now. You know, same God that parted the Red Sea and drained it around Pharaoh's army, he can take care of these guys too. But again, they're not logical or rational thinking about any of this because they're consumed with fear. You know, they're essentially curled up in the fetal position, ready to give up, you know, just saying, okay, I'll just go back to slavery. You know, and rational thinking has left the building. Now, to notice the effect of how this affects our minds, you know, you might want to keep a ribbon here because we're going to come back to this chapter and dissect this some more. But let's look at a similar account over in Deuteronomy chapter 1, where Moses is kind of retelling this story. It's Deuteronomy chapter 1 and verse 19. So we departed from Horeb and went through all the great and terrible wilderness which you saw on the way to the mountains of the Amorites. And Jehovah our God had commanded us. Then we came to Kadesh Barnea. And I said to you, you have come to the mountains of the Amorites which Jehovah our God is giving us. Look, Jehovah our God has set the land before you. Go up and possess it. And Jehovah God of our fathers has spoken to you. Do not fear or be discouraged. And every one of you came near to me and said, let us send men before us and let them search out the land for us and bring back word to us of the way which we should go up and of the cities into which we shall come. And the plan pleased me well, so I took 12 of your men, one man from each tribe. And they departed and went up into the mountains and came to the valley of Eshcol and spied it out. And they also took some of the fruit of the land in their hands and brought it down to us. And they brought back word to us, saying, it is a good land which Jehovah our God is giving us. Nevertheless, you would not go up, but rebelled against the command of Jehovah your God. And you murmured in your tents and said, because Jehovah hates us, he has brought us out of the land of Egypt to deliver us into the hand of the Amorites to destroy us. Where can we go? Where can we go up? Our brethren have discouraged our hearts, saying the people are greater and taller than we, and the cities are great and fortified up to heaven. Moreover, we have seen the sons of Anakim there. Therefore, I said to you, do not be terrified or afraid of them. So you see that they were consumed with fear. But I want you to see here, when it talks about discouraging their hearts, their hearts were discouraged, what that's actually saying, because it gives us a lot of insight to how being consumed with the fear affects the physical mind. Now, the Hebrew word here that's translated as discouraged in English, is transliterated into English as masses. It's M-A-S-A-S. Strong's number 4549. And again, according to the Complete Word Study Dictionary of the Old Testament by Baker and Carpenter, it's defined as a verb meaning to melt, to dissolve. It indicates something is breaking up or turning to water. It is used figuratively of persons wasting away in sickness, of mountains breaking down, of persons' hearts melting, losing courage. I notice it refers to it as like melting or dissolving, you know, just going away to nothing. Now, what is it referring to as melting or dissolving? Now, if we look at the Hebrew word here translated as heart in English, it's transliterated as lebab, L-E-B-A-B. It's Strong's number 3824. And again, I'll give you the definition from Baker and Carpenter. It says, quote, a masculine noun meaning heart, mind, inner person. It is also used to describe the place where the rational thinking process occurs that allows a person to know God's blessings, to plan for the future, to communicate and to understand God's message. In other words, the part of the mind that does rational, logical thinking, you know, that can plan for the future, you know, something that thinks through long consequences and asks, you know, how is this movie going to end? If I take this action, you know, what does it lead to? And where is this ultimately going to go? What happens to that part of the mind? Just melts away. You know, just melts or dissolves, because that's what happens when we panic. I'm sure all of us have been in situations in our lives where, you know, something happened that just rattled our cage and got us scared or panicked. And if you think about how you respond and act when that happens, it's typically not very logical, is it? You know, it's oftentimes irrational, and sometimes we just do downright stupid things, you know, because we're not thinking straight, because we're rattled and we're just trying to get away from the immediate fear, you know, the immediate danger that we're perceiving. And oftentimes we don't make real logical choices. You know, we don't think things through. We don't think of, you know, where this is going to lead to if I go down this, or what are my options available here? You know, what's the best way to handle this? Oftentimes that logical, analytical approach to things, it just leaves the building entirely, you know, and we're just immediately, you know, out of panic and fear trying to respond to something that's taking place here. Well, if you notice, I mean, how this affected, again, we've all experienced this as individuals, but look at this on a national level for Israel. This cost them the promised land. You know, panic went throughout the whole congregation. They're immediately looking to just run back to Egypt, you know, and volunteer to be slaves again. And the consequences were devastating. It was ruin and disaster, because the promised land's right there in front of them, but they can't see that they can go take that, and God's going to take care of them. You know, and the way they responded to this, again, was irrational, but it was devastating in terms of the consequences of their lives. You know, they all wind up dying in the wilderness. And again, we can take these principles and kind of, you know, apply them to our own lives. And again, I'm sure we've all been in situations where, you know, something in our life overwhelmed us with fear. And we look back at how we responded at the time and, you know, the decisions that we made and go, well, that wasn't very logical. You know, that wasn't very smart. Well, we weren't thinking very logical or smart at the time. We were responding to fear. You know, and again, that's something that, you know, not only can, you know, dominate the lives of individuals, it can dominate large groups of people. And people that think with fear oftentimes are easily manipulated, you know, because again, they don't think very clearly, you know, because they're not thinking logically. And just to give an example of something I think that, you know, that we see playing out in our world today, you know, in right now, in not only in our own nation, but in other places as well, that again, if you just think at it from a logical, analytical perspective, you can see red flags in it. The logic that you oftentimes hear today, particularly in the last few months, kind of goes like this. We've got to protect the vaccinated from the unvaccinated by forcing the vaccine on the unvaccinated to protect the vaccinated. Now, regardless of what you think of vaccination, your opinions of that, just apply a little common sense and logic to this. Because again, you don't need to be a medical expert. Just think logically. It either works or it doesn't. if it works, the definition of a vaccine that works is it protects you from being infected. So if you received it, you're protected. If you're protected, you don't need to worry about, you don't have a threat of the unprotected. It doesn't make sense. If you're still in danger of, you know, needing protection from that, well, that means you weren't protected. In what sense would it make to force the protection that didn't protect the vaccinated on everybody else? See, it doesn't even pass common sense. It's not even logical. Why do large groups of people fall into that kind of thinking? 2 years of fear? 2 years of a message of be afraid, you're all going to die? You know, and not thinking that through, well, what are the all options? And let me look into the facts and, you know, let me evaluate this. Well, if people are just responding with fear, again, not real logical decisions taking place. And again, this can happen on a large scale with people. It can happen in our individual lives. It's one of the reasons why fear is so dangerous, because again, it's a snare. It sets people up for ruin and disaster. It can make us easily manipulated, you know, particularly by Satan, you know, or from other individuals that might want to, you know, manipulate us for nefarious purposes. That's one of the reasons we can't allow fear to overcome our lives. Because another thing that can happen with fear is people's fears can be manipulated to not only just take them from fear, but to then turn into then anger and hatred. Now let's turn back over to Numbers 14. In Numbers 14, we'll kind of finish out some of the rest of the story here. I want you to see how the same fear that dominated the people, how else they responded. They weren't just being irrational and saying, well, let's run back to Egypt and be slaves. Notice what else they did. It's Numbers chapter 14 and verse 5. And Moses and Aaron fell on their faces before all the assembly of the congregation of the children of Israel. And Joshua the son of Nun and Caleb the son of Jephunneh, who were among those who had spied out the land, tore their clothes, and they spoke to all the congregation of the children of Israel, saying, the land we pass through to spy out is an exceedingly good land. If Jehovah delights in us, then he will bring us into this land and give it to us, a land which flows with milk and honey. Only do not rebel against Jehovah, nor fear the people of the land. For they are our bread, and their protection has departed from them. And Jehovah is with us. Do not fear them. But now notice how the congregation responded to the two people that are telling them the truth, who are giving them a good report, but are also telling them, you need to face your fears. Let's get over our fears and go do what God said. In verse 10, and all the congregation said to stone them with stones. Now the glory of Jehovah appeared in the tabernacle of meeting before all the children of Israel. I notice their fear went from, we're all afraid, let's run back to Egypt, you know, and be slaves, to, let's just kill those two guys. You know, they're telling us a message we don't want to hear. You know, they're telling us to face our fears, you know, and to go in and take the promised land. And suddenly this turns into anger and hatred. Well, this is how populations can be manipulated. Again, just to briefly address this, if you look back at some of the history of World War II, you know, as Hitler was taking over and, you know, so slowly coming into power, part of the propaganda that was used among the people was getting them to fear that the Jews are responsible for all your problems. You know, those bad Jews, they're the source of all the trouble. Well, you get them to fear one another, you know, and then that fear then turns to hatred. And what happened on a national basis? People sat by and allowed absolute atrocities to take place and went along with it because, you know, fear was one of the tools of propaganda that manipulated them, you know, and what resulted in the end? Absolute disaster. You know, this was a very ugly situation that took place. And again, this is one of the reasons why God looks at fear and says, this is such a bad thing. You know, if you're dominated by this, we're going to throw you in the lake of fire. This is one of the reasons why. Is because of what this, you know, the ugly things this can lead to. It's not just an issue of us, again, you know, feeling some fear or trepidation in our personal lives. You got to look at, if we allow this to dominate us, how does it end? You know, what does it ultimately result in? Now let's turn back over to Numbers 13 and verse 32. As I mentioned here, you know, we're going to look at what the bad report here is referring to, because I think that's kind of significant as well. And again, in verse 32 of chapter 13, it says, and they gave the children of Israel a bad report of the land, which they had spied out. Now, I'm reading from the New King James translation of the Bible. If you look at Young's literal translation, the way it translate that verse is, they bring out an evil account of the land which they have spied unto the sons of Israel. Now, to look at the meaning of the Hebrew word here, to see, okay, which one of these is correct? Is it just a bad report, or is it an evil report? Well, the word could actually mean, could be translated as both. The Hebrew word is dibah, it's D-I-B-B-A-H. It's Strong's number 1681. And again, I'm going to give you the definition from Baker and Carpenter. It says, quote, a feminine noun meaning slander, bad report, calumny. So you see that the definition here can encompass anything from just what we could call bad news. You know, bad news could be something we just don't want to hear. You know, it can be absolutely truthful, accurate information that's communicated up to us with no ill intent at all, but it's just something we didn't want to hear. You know, it was something that was unpleasant, and we don't, you know, want to hear that. That can be bad news, but notice it can also mean slander. Now, slander is a totally different situation, because, you know, slander is typically false information, you know, that's given with more evil intent. You know, so I mean, the meaning of the word can, you know, again, has a kind of a spectrum. It can be anything from just, you know, negative news you didn't want to hear, all the way to slander. Well, to add a little more clarity to this, look over in Numbers 14, in verse 36. And again, I'm going to read out of the New King James here. It's Numbers 14 and verse 36. And the men whom Moses set to spy out the land, who returned and made all the congregation murmur against him by bringing a bad report of the land, those very men who brought the evil report about the land died by the plague before Jehovah. I notice in, you know, even the New King James has in verse 37 an evil report, but there's a reason why that, because there's an extra word there in verse 37. Now, in verse 36 and verse 37, the word dibah that we've already talked about appears in both verses. But there's also an additional word in verse 37. It's the Hebrew word ra. It's transliterated R-A. And it's Strong's number 7451. And Baker and Carpenter defines it as this: an adjective meaning bad, evil. The basic meaning of this word displays 10 or more various shades of the meaning of evil according to its contextual usage. It means bad in a moral and ethical sense, and is used to describe, along with good, the entire spectrum of good and evil. Hence, it depicts evil in an absolute negative sense, as when it describes the tree of knowledge of good and evil. So again, if you look at it and you add that extra word, realize that, you know, this verse is correctly translated as an evil report. Now put all this into the context of the whole situation that took place here. You know, I contrasted the story here in, you know, Numbers 13 and 14 with the story we read in Exodus. Because, you know, in Exodus, that was a situation where the people are trapped. You know, there's mountains on both sides, there's water in front of them, and they can literally see the army, you know, coming up from the rear here. And it's a very rational thought to go, they're coming to kill us, you know. We've got an imminent threat. It's coming right at us. I can see it coming. You know, you can understand their response of fear. This is not exactly what happened in Numbers. You know, in this situation, they're not cornered like that. There's not an army coming at them. You know, in fact, the people that are responding with so much panic, they didn't even see what was going on in the Promised Land. What happened in their case is they got a bad report of people coming back and telling them, be afraid, you're all going to die. You know, now they you know, Joshua and Caleb were there giving them a more balanced approach to it all, but they listened to the message of fear. You know, basically, if you put the modern day terminology that we've heard, you know, particularly in the last few years, I'll just use a term that we've all heard a lot, they got sucked in by fake news. You know, they got fake news and, you know, basically anti-God propaganda. You know, you can't trust in God. No, we're all going to die. We need to go back to Egypt. you know, and wouldn't listen to the, you know, Joshua and Caleb who were giving them the accurate story, you know. But see, this is what can happen to large groups of people manipulated by fear. And notice, you know, what devastating consequences it had. But because for Israel, they literally lost out on the promised land because of fear. You know, because they were afraid and they wouldn't trust in God, it literally cost them the reward of their covenant. You know, and it can do the same thing to us. Because as the Bible tells us, we can lose out on our promised land, which is the kingdom of God, if we allow fear to dominate our lives. And now let's take the rest of the sermon here and look at how this applies to us in our spiritual lives. Turn over to John chapter 12. John chapter 12 and verse 42. It says, "Nevertheless, even among the rulers, many believed in him, but because of the Pharisees, they did not confess him, lest they should be put out of the synagogue. For they love the praise of men more than the praise of God." And there's the him it's referring to here is obviously Jesus Christ, you know, and it's referring to a number of individuals that, you know, they understood who Christ was, you know, and they really believed he was the Messiah, but they didn't want to be, you know, unpopular in their society. They're like, well, you know, if we profess that Christ is who he says he is and we follow him, well, the Pharisees are going to turn on us and they're going to kick us out. You know, and we're going to get socially ostracized and the peer pressure is going to be pretty negative, you know, so we don't want to face that, you know, and they allowed that fear of men to cause them to deny Christ. Well, this can be a very devastating thing. You know, Christ takes this very seriously. Turn over to Matthew chapter 10. It's Matthew chapter 10 and verse 32. "Therefore, whoever confesses me before men, him I will also confess before my Father who is in heaven. But whoever denies me before men, him I will also deny before my Father who is in heaven." As we know, there's only one name under heaven by which we can be saved, and that's Christ. If we're not willing to accept him as our Savior and to be proud about that, you know, what does Christ say? "I'll deny you before the Father." You know, if you're afraid of men and you're not willing to face some pain, you know, to show that you're my follower, that's not going to work. I won't accept that. You know, and see, that's exactly the situation that we all have agreed to when we were baptized. Let's turn over to Luke chapter 14. Look at a common set of scriptures that probably all of us read as we were being counseled for baptism. Luke chapter 14. Luke chapter 14 and verse 25. "And great multitudes went with him, and he turned and said to them, 'If anyone comes to me and does not hate his father, mother, wife, children, brothers, and sisters, yes, in his own life also, he cannot be my disciple.'" Notice he's saying if we're not willing to face pain and loss in our lives, you know, to obtain the kingdom of God, then we're not worthy of it. "And whoever does not bear his cross and come after me cannot be my disciple. For which of you intending to build a tower does not sit down first and count the cost, whether he has enough to finish it? Lest after he laid the foundation and is not able to finish it, all who see it begin to mock him, and saying that this man began to build and was not able to finish. For what king, going to make war against another king, does not sit down first and consider whether he is able with 10,000 to meet him who comes against him with 20,000? Or else, while the other is still a great way off, he sends a delegation and asks conditions of peace. So likewise, whoever of you does not forsake all that he has cannot be my disciple." Notice he doesn't say this is a suggestion. You know, "I'd really prefer if you had courage and were willing to face these things." He says, no, if you're not willing to go through trials, to suffer loss, you know, to give up everything in your life to pursue salvation, then you won't make it. You know, because see, the reason courage is a requirement for salvation, we've got to have courage to be able to do that. You know, if we're afraid of men, if we're afraid of losing our lives or losing our jobs or losing, you know, well, whatever it is, and we're not willing to give it up, you know, to pursue the kingdom of God, you know, that's a big problem. You know, and, yeah, and again, we all struggle. We all have our times we fall short. You know, God is very merciful in doing that. But he says, in realizing we have to be willing to face harsh trials, you know, and typically when we're baptized and we read through these words, it's academic. You know, I remember the minister who baptized me kind of went over this, and he covered this in great detail, you know, to make sure I remembered it. And even looked me in the eye, and he goes, I know as you read this today, it's really just words, it's academic. He said, but I'm covering this like this because, he goes, when the trials come upon you, and it happens, I want you to remember this conversation and to remember what you agreed to. And I am so glad he did that, because I can't tell you how many times in my life when a very painful trial has come upon me and that conversation flashes back in my mind, I go, well, I was warned. You know, he told me this was going to happen, you know, and it did. Because, see, we have to fear God more than we fear men. Turn over to Matthew chapter 10. Matthew chapter 10, we'll start reading in verse 16. Behold, I send you out as sheep in the midst of wolves. Therefore, be wise as serpent and harmless as doves. But beware of men, for they will deliver you up to councils and scourge you in their synagogues. And you will be brought before governors and kings for my sake, as a testimony to them and to the Gentiles. But when they deliver you up, do not worry about how or what you should speak, for it will be given to you in the hour and what you should speak. For it is not you who speak, but the Spirit of your Father who speaks in you. Now brother will deliver up brother to death, and father his child, and children will rise up against parents and cause them to be put to death. And you will be hated by all for my name's sake, but he who endures to the end will be saved. But when they persecute you in the city, flee to another. For assuredly I say to you, you will have not gone through all the cities of Israel before the Son of Man comes. A disciple is not above his teacher, nor a servant above his master. It is enough for a disciple to be like his teacher, and a servant like his master. And if they have called the master of the house Beelzebub, how much more will they call those in his household? Therefore, do not fear them, for there is nothing covered that will not be revealed, and hidden that will not be known. Whatever I tell you in the dark, speak in the light, and what you hear in the ear, preach on the housetops. And do not fear those who kill the body, but cannot kill the soul, but rather fear him who is able to destroy both soul and body in hell. And are not two sparrows sold for a copper coin, and not one of them falls to the ground apart from your Father's will. But the very hairs of your head are all numbered. Do not fear, therefore. You are more value than many sparrows. See, he repeatedly tells us we've got to fear God more than we fear men. Because it's natural for us as carnal human beings, we fear what we can see, you know, what's in front of us, the immediate threat that we see coming at us. You know, and this is why we have to understand, again, there's the correlation between faith in God and courage. You know, if our focus is upon God and his ability to deliver us, that gives us courage. If we're looking at just our physical lives, you know, what's physically around us, we tend to cower in fear. We curl up in the fetal position and we just want to, you know, give up and be defeated. Now, let's look briefly at a very good example in the Bible of having this kind of faith. Turn over to Daniel chapter 3. It's a very common story I'm sure we're all familiar with. It's Daniel chapter 3. This is where Nebuchadnezzar, you know, puts up an idol and basically commands everybody to worship it. It says, you know, when you hear the music come on, everyone is commanded to bow down and to worship this image, and if you don't, I'm going to kill you. You know, I'm going to throw you in a fiery furnace. Well, as you know, with Nebuchadnezzar's reputation, it was obvious he was serious about this. You know, and when Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego refused to comply, you know, when their answer is, I will not comply, you know, I will not go along with this because you're directly violating God's instructions, you know, and they don't do it, they know he's for real. You know, they know he'll really throw them, you know, in the fire, and he did. Yeah, but let's notice that their response in verse 16. And Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego answered and said to the king, O Nebuchadnezzar, we have no need to answer you in this matter. In other words, we fear God more than you. In verse 17, if that is the case, our God whom we serve is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace, and he will deliver us from your hand, O king. But if not, let it be known, O God, and known to you, O king, that we do not serve your gods, nor will we worship the golden image you have set up. Now notice, they're not totally sure exactly how this movie is going to end, you know, because they say, our God is able to deliver us, but even if he chooses to let us die, just let it be known, I will not comply. You know, I will not go along with your order. You're asking me to forsake my God, and I fear him more than I fear you. You know, now, you know, realistically, we all like to read these stories and we cheer on the heroes, and we'd all like to believe, you know, when this, the situation comes for us, that we'll be as courageous as them. And oftentimes we're not. You know, I've seen this meme on Facebook a number of times recently, and I think it would be relevant to this particular, you know, sermon here. It's a picture of obviously Germany in the 1930s, and you see this crowd. And everybody in the crowd, you know, is doing the Heil Hitler, you know, this symbol there. And you see this one guy standing in the crowd, and he's not saluting. You know, he's not going along with it. You know, and you see the picture, and there's a circle around him. And it says, we'd all like to believe that when the time comes, we'll be this guy. In other words, we'll be the guy that stands up and won't do it. All too often, though, we're not. You know, when the pressure comes on, we start rationalizing our mind, well, maybe I should give it because I don't want to have to face the pain, you know, of whatever it is in our life, you know, whatever is the trial that's got us, you know, befuddled. You know, but sometimes we have to realize, and sometimes we just have to climb up out of that fetal position and just remember, you know, that we don't know how this story is going to end. And just say to ourselves, all I know is the God that I serve is able to save me from Nebuchadnezzar. Because sometimes you just have to get up out of that fetal position, you know, and face it and have faith in him and realize that he will strengthen you through it. But the first step with that is asking for it. Turn over to Philippians chapter 4. Philippians chapter 4 and verse 6. It says, be anxious for nothing, but in everything by prayer and supplication, with thanksgiving, let your request be made known to God. In other words, go to him and ask. And notice what happens in verse 7. And the peace of God, which surpasses all understanding, will guard your hearts and minds through Christ Jesus. In other words, if we admit to him, we're frail, we're scared, you know, that fear has overcome us, and we just go and ask for help. Give me courage to face this. He'll give you peace and he'll strengthen you. Because see, his spirit is not a spirit of fear. It's a spirit of courage. So turn over to 2 Timothy. 2 Timothy chapter 1, verse 6. Therefore I remind you to stir up the gift of God, which is in you through the laying on of my hands. For God has not given us a spirit of fear, but of power and of love and of a sound mind. In other words, if we reach out to God and we tell him, hey, I'm frail, I'm weak, I'm a carnal human being, you know, and fear is overcoming me, and we ask for that help, he'll give us the spirit of courage. He will take away our fear and enable us to be courageous enough to face our trials. We have to realize that it's just like faith. We have to take action. You know, so sometimes even though you're scared, you know, you have to realize, and I love the way that the Winston Churchill put it. He said, fear is a reaction, courage is a decision. In other words, you decide, okay, I'm going to get up out of the fetal position. I'm not going to let this overcome my life. I'm going to fight back. I'm going to stand up, and I'm going to remember that the God that I served is able to save me from Nebuchadnezzar. Because you see, that's how it works. Turn over to James chapter 2. James chapter 2. We'll start in verse 14. What does it profit, my brethren, if someone says he has faith but does not have works? Can faith save him? If a brother or sister is naked and destitute of daily food, And one of you says to him, depart in peace, be warmed and filled. Do you not, and you do not give him the things which are needed for the body, what does it profit? Thus also faith by itself, if it does not have works, is dead. But someone will say, you have faith and I have works. Show me your faith without your works, and I will show you my faith by my works. You believe that there is one God, and you do well. Even the demons believe and tremble. But do you not know, O foolish man, that faith without works is dead? Was not Abraham our father justified by works when he offered Isaac his son on the altar? Do you see that faith was working together with his works? And by works, faith was made perfect. And the scripture was fulfilled, which says, Abraham believed God, and it was accounted to him for righteousness. And he was called the friend of God. You see that a man is justified by works and not by faith only. Likewise, was not Rahab the harlot also justified by works when she received the messengers and sent them out another way? For as the body is without the spirit is dead, faith without works is also dead. Because see, it takes action. It's not just words that we say that I believe or when the time comes, I'll do that. Sometimes we have to decide to take action. And again, as Winston Churchill said, you know, fear is a reaction, courage is a decision. You know, sometimes we have to decide, I'm just going to have courage. Even though I'm feeling fear, I feel terrified, that my future is uncertain, but no, I'm going to decide, you know, to trust in God and to pursue this. And if we make that decision and show that faith, that we're making that, you know, decision and asking God for that help, he will strengthen us. He will give us courage. Turn over to Psalm 31. We'll see a couple examples of this with David. Psalm 31 and verse 21. Blessed be Jehovah, for he has shown me his marvelous kindness in a strong city. For I said in my haste, I am cut off before your eyes. In other words, you know, David's in the fetal position feeling defeated here. Nevertheless, you heard the voice of my supplications when I cried out to you. O love Jehovah, all you his saints, for Jehovah preserves the faithful and fully repays the proud person. Be of good courage, and he shall strengthen your heart, all you hope in Jehovah. In other words, if we show some faith and decide to have some courage, say, I'm just going to face this even though it's overwhelming me, I'm scared, my future's uncertain, I'm not sure what to do here, but I'm going to trust in him. He will strengthen you. You know, David tells us this multiple times. Turn over to Psalm 27. Psalm 27 and verse 11. Teach me your way, O Jehovah, and lead me in the smooth path because of my enemies. Do not deliver me to the will of my adversaries, for false witnesses have riven against me, such as breathe out violence. I would have lost heart unless I had believed that I would see the goodness of Jehovah in the land of the living. Notice he's saying, I would have succumbed and given in to my human weakness if I hadn't been, you know, deciding to trust in God. In verse 14, wait on Jehovah, be of good courage, and he shall strengthen your heart. Wait, I say, on Jehovah. See, he's saying that if we, you know, decide to have some courage, and you know, I'm going to stand up, I'm going to do what God says here, I'm going to trust in him to deliver me through whatever trial it is, you know, that you're facing, whatever challenge it is that you're having to overcome. If we make that decision that I'm going to believe in him, I'm going to show courage. And again, we go to him in prayer and ask for that help. You know, he will give us the peace that surpasses all understanding. He will strengthen our heart and he'll give us courage because that's how we develop it. Because I mentioned from the onset of the sermon, there's a strong correlation, you know, between courage and belief and faith in God. And there's also a strong correlation with cowardice, fearfulness, and lack of belief in God. The key to courage is trusting in God. And again, that starts oftentimes with a decision. a decision when you're not feeling real courageous, you're not feeling like you're on top of this, you're scared, you know, and you're stressed out. You know, but if you make that decision and ask for that help, He will strengthen us. So whatever trial that you're facing, whatever is coming against your life and possibly overwhelming you and you're not sure what to deal with, just remember these words. All I know is the God that I serve is able to save me from Nebuchadnezzar.